Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me is Armin Navabi. Armin, how are you today?
Good, good.
Today we're going to get right into it. There's a lot out of Pakistan. It's a country by birth. The group Tehreek-e-Labbaik, right, which is essentially the Islamic militant group in Pakistan. They're the ones who've been orchestrating the anti-France protests. The most recent one was last month that killed 10 people, including four police officers. And then this month, Pakistan has lifted the ban on the Islamic group. So this group was banned last year for their protest, the violent protests. And this year, recently, as of a couple of days ago, Pakistan lifted the ban. Just a few weeks ago, the Pakistani government had released hundreds of people from TLP, prisoners. So there's a lot going on, and you know we're going to talk today about whether this is a capitulation or you know what the plan is and what this means for the future of Pakistan, and we're also going to talk about the problem with France and what's going on. And to talk about it, actually, we have the perfect guest, Shan Thasir, the charming and eloquent Shan Thasir. Shan, I said I was going to say that, so sorry, I'm embarrassing you. Shan, for those of you who don't know, Shan is the eldest son of Salman Thasir, who was a former governor of Pakistan's largest province, Punjab, and who was unfortunately assassinated by his own bodyguard for showing solidarity with a poor Christian woman, Asiya Bibi, who was accused of blasphemy. So Shan is also an anti-blasphemy law activist, and he's done a lot of great work in that regard too. And we've had previous episodes of with him where he's talked about it. So, Shan, let's start with this this thing. So this is not anything new, like as you were saying. This is something that's pretty much in the character of what Pakistan's been doing in terms of their dealings with Tehreek-e-Labbaik.
Well, Ali, let's just look at the big picture. What's actually happening? What's going on in Pakistan? See, every few years, and now every few months with increasing frequency, the Tehreek-e-Labbaik claims that the honor of the Prophet is under threat, and the Tehreek-e-Labbaik translates into the party of Muhammad. It's a party which has essentially weaponized the Prophet, converted the Prophet essentially into an AK-47. So every few months, the Tehreek-e-Labbaik claims that the Prophet's honor has been insulted, and starts violent demonstrations across the country. And what we see after that, straight after that, is then the government and the Tehreek-e-Labbaik enter into a series of negotiations. I say negotiations, inverted commas, because that's also, you know, it's interesting what the terms of these negotiations are. But essentially, this is, broadly speaking, if you take sort of step back and take a sort of overview, look at this. This is the Tehreek-e-Labbaik bidding for power, for influence every few months. And it is basically the state retreating and ceding space after space after space. So this is an ongoing thing. It happens every few months.
But is it progressive? As in, this is the kind of thing where they ceded, like they gave up one boundary, let them cross it. And now they're giving up another one. So it's getting progressively worse, or is it more of a back and forth thing?
No, it's not a back and forth thing. You see, like I said, the Tehreek-e-Labbaik always has a demand, right? This time it's the expulsion of the French ambassador, but the real trick is that regardless of the demand and what it is, the mere fact that they hold these public demonstrations increases their legitimacy,
right,
increases their influence. It galvanizes their support base. It demonstrates their power, swells its ranks. So they have every incentive to do this every... Now, the last time they did it, for example, was May. Before that, something like this would happen every few years, back in 2017 and back about 5 years ago. It would happen every few years. And now it's happening increasingly. It is in the interest of the Tehreek-e-Labbaik to hold such a demonstration. But as far as their influence in society is concerned, regardless of whether their actual demands are met, the mere fact that every time they throw one of these national tantrums, the highest apparatus of the state, from the interior minister, the information minister, the prime minister, and all the assets of the state, are put at the service of these negotiations with the Tehreek-e-Labbaik. The mere fact that they can do that just makes them more and more relevant in the Pakistani political scene.
What is that? What's interesting to me about Pakistan, this has been like that with Pakistan all the time, is that there's a lot of influence of these sort of Islamic fundamentalist parties on the society. Within the society there is. But when it comes to elections, they don't really win those kinds of seats, the kind of thing that you would expect. And even though it has been increasing, it's still not the kind of proportion that you see in terms of public support, or the kind of proportions where the government responds to them and capitulates to them. I mean, what does the Pakistani government get out of this? What is their interest in this? Right. And so how is Tehreek-e-Labbaik, how is it performing in the elections? And do you think it's proportional to what it seems like their support is?
If you think of the fact that they came into existence essentially in 2016, they are the fourth or fifth largest party in Pakistan. They polled more votes than the Pakistan People's Party in Punjab. So they are a far second, for example, to the PTI, the ruling party, or the PMLN. They are a far second, but for a party that was just formed a few years ago, it's their election results shocked everyone. I don't recall the number. I think it was about 7 million votes or something like that. But so that's the first thing. The second thing is that they may have a smaller number of supporters, but their sympathizers sort of range across the nation. They range across all sort of political shades. Broadly speaking, there is a large sympathy for their cause, even if they don't get those votes. So their support base cuts across the country. The third thing I wanted to say, that, and this is the most important, that regardless of their political representation in terms of votes, their cultural influence is disproportional to that. Why? Because they hold the gun. They will kill you if you cross them. They have demonstrated that. That is what defines them, that desire for violence, for blood. So their influence is disproportional to their votes.
Got it. Yeah.
I just checked, by the way, in 2018, I think they got about 2 million votes.
2 million votes, not 7 million, yeah.
Yeah, this is... Sorry, Armin, did you have a question, or...?
So for people, this Tehreek-e-Labbaik, which we're gonna refer to them as TLP, just in case people don't know that we're using this interchangeably. They are, would we say, if you want to separate the powers that be in Pakistan, we have the civilian government, we have the army, and we have the mob, basically the Islamists in the streets, right?
Right.
Would you say is that a fair categorization of the powers that could influence Pakistan's politics? Between these three groups?
Well, yeah, yes. Even though Pakistan is sort of cuts across horizontally and vertically by class, by religion, by ethnicity, by politics, but this you could put them like
would
that.
Would you say the civilian government among these three, the civilian government is the weakest one, and it's basically the two main powers are the Islamists, which is the TLP, and the army?
I wouldn't grade it in terms of how weak they are, but I would say that there is a nexus between the military establishment and the TLP. See, the military, and I'll sort of explain a little bit historically about what that nexus is, because it requires a little bit of historical context. See, the military establishment in Pakistan has a history of harnessing forces, political forces, to counter genuine democratic movements. In the 1980s and 1990s, during the time of General Zia, they did that with the religious parties like the Jamaat-e-Islami. They did it with the militant sectarian outfits called the Sipah-e-Sahaba, Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, Lashkar-e-Taiba. In the 2000s, General Musharraf created this party of clerics called the Mutahida Majlis, Mutahida MMA, basically. So basically what happened in 2010, after my father's murder and at the funeral of Mumtaz Qadri, millions of people poured out on the street. And this was basically political power. It was political dynamite. Now, someone saw that this raw political power, the strength of these emotions can be harnessed. So shortly after that, Khadim Rizvi rose to power. A few years after that, the TLP contested the elections. And now you see that the TLP has a sort of a symbiotic relationship with the establishment. And you can look at that relationship when you compare the way the military establishment deals with the TLP and deals, for example, with other nationalist movements, sort of like the Baloch nationalist movement, the Pashtun nationalist movements. Now, these are movements that the military definitely doesn't want. So what happens there? People get abducted. They disappear. They're called missing persons. No TLP goon ever disappears. Their activities are banned. They don't hold rallies. They can't hold meetings. If you so much as fly one of their flags, you get picked up. Now, you compare that with the way the military deals with the TLP, and what you see is that this is a party that it's in the interests of the military to have them there to counter genuine political movements. Because, see, the military is the most powerful player in Pakistani politics. It's not threatened by any of these sectarian religious parties. Its only threat comes from genuine democratic movements. So it's in their interest to have an alliance and work with the TLP. Of course, as violent political proxies go, this alliance is never smooth. It's a love-hate relationship. It's a dalliance. They turn against them at times. But it is basically in the interest of the Pakistan military for people like the Sipah-e-Sahaba, the TLP, the Urban Taliban, to have these sort of undemocratic movements.
So the military uses the TLP as a way to fight back against the civilian government's influence, like to put them in a corner. But could this backfire? Because the civilian government and Imran Khan is giving in more and more to the TLP, giving into the demand, just accepting whatever they say, and also keep signaling that everything they want, he will try to do for them. When it comes to making Muhammad like being the Khatam al-Anbiya, the last prophet, just that becoming the slogan everywhere, Quran classes, celebrations for Muhammad, attacking minority groups, recognizing them, making them legal again as a political party. But at some point, could this backfire on the military in the way that if we keep going in this way, is it possible that the civilian government will completely fall apart And then at that point, like, I don't see it as a TLP as a force that will at some point be satisfied. Like, it's not like once you let them loose, they want to keep devouring anything.
No, by definition, they can't be satisfied because it is in their demands that their power come from, not the fulfillment of them. You're right.
Yeah, but is it possible that once there's no more, any more civilian government to devour, would it turn on the military? And maybe now, right now, they're not a threat to the military, but is it possible that at some point they will become one? I mean, the reason why I'm saying that is because as an Iranian myself, I am I'm remembering Mohammad Reza Shah, who used the Islamists as a way to fight the communists.
Yes.
And give them power and give in to them. And when he started doing that, it didn't seem like the Islamists would ever have the power to topple the military of the Shah. Yes. But then eventually he gave in to them so much that they became powerful enough that they completely removed Shah and his entire military force. So is that possible for that to happen to Pakistan?
Yeah, look, that would be a worst case scenario. That would essentially be things falling apart. But what is clear is that the relationship with its proxies is always one of friction. Like the proxies that were developed in the 80s and 90s, basically terrorist groups, turned on the state of Pakistan in the early 2000s. So this relationship can go very, very ugly. And that's the inherent nature of raising a tiger in your basement. I mean, he could devour you one day. So that's not something you can rule out. But that is basically it's essentially the nature of the dalliance that the Pakistan military has with the civilian government and with its proxies. It's basically, Pakistan is a hybrid democracy. It's a power sharing arrangement between the military and the civilian governments. It was an overt democracy in the 80s, but now it's like a power sharing. And it's very important for these are the cards of the military government. So it's very important that they play them well. Important in their interest. But of course, you're right. I mean, things could go horribly wrong.
Well, I mean, they have in the past with them. I mean, if you look at the Pakistani Taliban, you know, when you had the Taliban, you had the you remember when they were talking about the good Taliban and the bad Taliban?
Well, yeah.
So you had the Afghani groups, you had these, the Afghan Taliban, which was in Pakistan's interest to have a relationship with them as a buffer against India. Oh, yeah. On the other hand, when the Pakistani Taliban on the Pakistani side of the border in Swat started doing all the crap they were doing, you know, a few years ago, there was a spate of terror.
No, but before that, there was a spate
of
terrorist attacks in the late 2000s across Pakistan.
Right. Yeah.
On the military and in civilian places. So things can go horribly wrong in one direction or another.
Mm-hmm. And then they mitigate it. So another thing, speaking of Afghanistan, I wanted to ask you about this too. You've had this the situation with the TLP. You know, it's been going. It's not really anything new. But recently, with the US pulling out of Afghanistan, the Taliban taking over in Afghanistan, right? Uh-huh. Which is, it seems like that's something that, you know, the Pakistani ISI, the Pakistani army, felt was in their interest. Again, because, you know, they have India on their mind. Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic, about why the Pakistan is sympathetic and wants the Taliban in Afghanistan, and what their the benefits that they get out of it?
Well, here is from my reading of the way the Pakistani establishment sees the situation in Afghanistan. They see the Taliban there as, you know, a permanent reality. And, you know, dare I say, there's an element of realism in that. We were never going to have a situation where the Americans come and create a lovely flowering democracy of liberal centrist Democrats in Afghanistan. That never happens with American invasions. No. If anything, it radicalizes the country more. Now, President Musharraf said this to, I think it was in his conversations with Bush or someone else in the administration. he said that do not, that use as little violence as possible, because the Taliban are not going to go away. So the Pakistan military maintains a constant relationship with the Taliban because they are going to have to live with them. The Americans can leave, they can pack up and go, but Pakistan shares a border with them. So whether they sort of, it's in their interest for the Taliban to return or not is a secondary issue. I think the primary issue is that there's an element of realism in that they always knew this was coming sooner or later. So it was never in their interest over the last, 20 years since the war has been happening, to cut off all relationships with the Taliban. They always maintained relationships for that reason.
Right, right. And yes, go ahead, Armin.
No, I'm going to switch to a different topic, but if you're asking a question along the same thing, continue before I switch it.
Yeah, I had one more question related to this, that there are several, you know, with these Islamic fundamentalist parties, right now there are Islamic fundamentalist parties that are actually enemies with each other. So in Afghanistan, you've got the Islamic State of, you know, Khorasan, you've got ISIS-K, and then you have the Taliban, and they don't like each other. You have the Pakistani Taliban that was around, I guess that's more of a thing in the past, and now you have the TLP. What is the relationship right now with the TLP and the Taliban, and does that impact its influence on the Pakistani government at this point, you think? Or do you know anything about it?
I can't speak much to that beyond what is out in the public sphere.
Yeah.
But what I do know is, or what I have heard, and I think there's a lot of truth here, is that there's one myth to dispel, which is that the TLP are not in Pakistan's pocket. They are genuinely a force to be reckoned with. They are a player that the military has to deal with. And the other thing is that the TLP and the Afghan Taliban, there's no real boundary between them. It's similar elements in both of them. They're both part of a larger sort of a political presence.
Right.
It's a marriage of Pashtun tribalism and Wahhabism, a form of ideology.
Yes, you could say that. But I mean, it's also like Wahhabism is the only. It's the only idea around. You know, the Taliban is what you get when you educate young kids in a madrasa with one ideology. So they are soaked in that. There's the marketplace of ideas is empty. So Wahhabism is basically their way of life. It's the Taliban is what you get when you bring young boys up in a madrasa without any female company, brainwashed all their lives. And these madrasas are very violent places. Children are beaten from a very young age and they are rote learned. So the ideology is instilled into them, and that's the only game in town, as far as the Taliban is concerned.
Well, the interesting thing is that recently there is a somewhat of a competing Islamist movement, competing to Wahhabism, that is influencing Taliban, and that's the Muslim Brotherhood version of Islamism, which is, like, if you look at the Taliban's, the Kandahari Taliban's, they're being influenced by Doha and Turkey, and they are, like, it's very interesting because these are the Kandahari Taliban's are the founders of Taliban. And they're moving a little bit from Wahhabism to Muslim Brotherhood version of Islam. But the other sect of Taliban, which is the Haqqani network, they are still in line with the Wahhabi version of Islam. And they are the ones that are more in touch with the ISI.
Yeah.
And ISI would like them to be more in control of the future of Afghanistan rather than the Doha Kandahari Taliban that used to be the founders. So there's a competing interest like happening. This is
not just ideological. It also comes from the fact that there are a lot of power brokers involved in that part of the world. I mean, when that place is fragmenting, a lot of regional powers weren't just sitting around sort of watching and doing nothing. So a lot of these movements are sort of dictated by the power brokers that support them.
Right. So I had a question about Imran Khan, like, because I see a lot of liberal and atheist Pakistanis being upset about how much hope they had with Imran Khan. And now they're all like, you watch him becoming more and more Islamist and giving in, being obsessed with all these like Prophet Muhammad being the last prophet and just virtue signaling to Islamists all the time. And being completely influenced by his wife and all. Haris Sultan keeps like, every time Imran Khan is mentioned by Haris Sultan, he keeps saying like, oh, we had so much hope and all of our hope went down the drain and stuff like that. But I kind of feel bad for Imran Khan because I don't know if I would do anything different if I was in his position, looking at all these Islamists like marching on the Capitol and everything. I would be like, I mean, I would like to, you know, I would be scared. Like, given the amount of influence that the TLP has, can we like really blame Imran Khan for like bending the knee to them? Like, don't you need to do that for your survival? Like, it's not like he has any power against them.
No. Armin, this story goes back to the 90s when Imran first entered politics. So Imran's sort of shift towards Islamism came sort of right after his playboy years were over and he started eyeing a career in politics. Now, I can't say whether this is driven by expediency or whether there's a genuine sort of religious awakening in his heart, because I can't look into his heart, but there was it's something that, you know, happens, you know, it often happens to middle-aged Pakistani men when they see, you know, they've come to sort of half their life. I suppose it happens to middle-aged Irani men also. When they come to about half their life, they see, well, maybe now's a good time to start taking out, insurance.
Repenting.
Take out some sort of celestial insurance for the next world that we may come to. Imran started messaging very conservatively in the 90s, right? But the other thing is that, you know, but liberal Pakistan, liberals that you're talking about, the Pakistanis, that's a very small sliver of society. And God bless them. And, you know, they're great people, I'm sure. But you'll never win an election with these guys. If you want to come into mainstream politics in Pakistan, your message, you know, given the social fabric of Pakistan, regardless of the Tehreek-e-Labek, Pakistan is a very conservative country. It's a very religiously conservative country, and especially so has become since the Afghan war and since the 80s. So any politician that wants a broad-based appeal in Pakistan can't pander to, you know, our dear liberal friends, has to have the kind of element in his messaging that Imran does.
Yeah, this is you're right about
it's
that.
It's sad, but it's true.
Yeah, it's something I was thinking, the question, but that's a different question from whether he could have done things differently, because, you know, so Armin, to add to that, just to remember his nickname, what his nickname used to be when he first entered politics, they used to call him Taliban Khan, because he was, when Musharraf wanted to actually fight, you know, Musharraf was playing that double game, he was going around talking about how we need to negotiate with them, and, you know, he had a lot of sympathy for them, and people did have a lot of issues with that. But he has come up and he has sort of maintained all of those, the discrimination against the Ahmadi Muslims and, you know, all of the, because those are things that you absolutely have to maintain in order to stay in power in Pakistan.
No, but you know, in a way, I'll tell you where I feel sorry for him, because when he came to power, he wanted to appoint this prominent Ahmadi economist. I forget his name, but he wanted to sort of appoint him in a very senior role in Pakistan economic planning.
What's his name? Sorry, I forgot his name.
Akif?
Yes. Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
So he I don't think he had an anti-Ahmadi bone in his body. I don't even think he even thought about it. But the moment, then there was a fury after that, and a lot of noise was made, and he suddenly came out and said, "Yes, yes, yes, of course, I support the ostracization of the Ahmadis." So you can see that regardless of whether this is genuine, there's an element of expediency in Imran Khan which is undeniable.
So for people who might not know, we have to actually make this clip because we are assuming people know what Ahmadis. Ahmadis are the most discriminated against and threatened minority group in Pakistan. And the reason why in Pakistan there's this heavy focus on saying that Muhammad was the last prophet was because of the Ahmadi Muslims consider Muslim prophets after Muhammad, and this whole signaling that Muhammad was the last prophet is an anti-Ahmadi discrimination tactic, right? So this is like hating on the Ahmadis and using them as a scapegoat for everything that goes wrong. And basically, they're the Jews of Pakistan. We could say that
they are the Jews. They are the Jews of Pakistan. If Pakistan was, 1939 Germany.
Actually, I mean that's pretty fair to say, right? Like right before the concentration camps, this is right now. It's comparable situation. Like the fact that we don't talk about it that much is kind of shameful as well, because by all means, the amount of, like, if you're an Ahmadi in Pakistan right now, like, you're living in fear. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yes. Just yesterday, a man was killed in the northern city of Peshawar, just shot, only because he's Ahmadi. And wow. And this happens every month, every 2 weeks, every sort of many times over the year. An Ahmadi is shot. Now, the thing is that, by the United Nations, I've forgotten the actual resolution number, the definition of genocide is where a group is threatened. The mere threat of destruction is genocide. You don't have to wait for millions and millions of people to be slaughtered before you call it genocide. But there's a resistance to calling it a genocide. So, but if you are an Ahmadi in Pakistan today, you live in fear of your life to be killed randomly. And by the way, these are Ahmadis who just live non-prominent lives. If you're prominent in any way, like if you're a doctor, if you're a well-known member of society, you will randomly, many doctors get murdered. So that is how you create fear of a minority. It's not about the number of people you kill, but the very fact that certain people are systematically killed for their religion sort of sends a minority underground. It creates a cultural genocide. It creates a fear before an actual genocide happens.
Right. And I think that the comparison you made to, like, 1932 Germany is pretty apt. I mean, Godwin's law does not apply here. And just for the audience, we were talking about the economist that was removed. So his name was Atif Mia, and he was a Princeton economist. So he came from, he'd been trained at Princeton, and he was appointed. And then they asked him to step down overtly only because of he was an Ahmadi. That's the only reason he was asked to step down.
And things are now moving towards targeting Shias now in Pakistan as well, right? Like have been for a while. Like how bad things can get? Are they getting as aggressively anti-Shia as they have been anti-Ahmadi? Like,
no, they are less so now. The targeting of Shias started in the 1980s with the Afghan Jihad. You see, for the Afghan Jihad, they needed to nurture the most violent groups, such as the Lashkar-e-Jhangvi. Now, the Lashkar-e-Jhangvi is essentially a sectarian outfit. It's a Sunni outfit, and their rallying, their sort of primary thing is anti-Shia. Shias are kafirs, Shias should be murdered. So it is these groups that were used for... Sorry, go on.
By the way, YouTube, that's not our view. I just want to signal if we get strike. Well, we're not saying anybody should be murdered. Like, I just want to, for the YouTube algorithm, we're talking about other people's views. Sorry, I have to put that because we might get a strike. But yeah, continue, sorry.
Lay off algorithm. Yeah, so basically it was these guys that were used to fight the Afghan war by the by the Americans and by Saudi money. So they were like the Russian gunship helicopter fodder that was sent from Pakistan to fight the Russians. So the quid pro quo of these people fighting the Afghan war is that they were essentially allowed to murder Shias in Pakistan. So in the 1980s, starting from there, and it's less so now, but there was an active murder campaign against Shias, against the Hazara communities, terrorism against them. So the group that has suffered the most violence in Pakistan is, more than the Ahmadis, I would say the Shias, and specifically the Hazara Shias, because they are Shias up north, where the recruitment for the Afghan war takes place.
So this, correct me if I'm wrong, this whole idea of getting the civilian government to attack the Ahmadis, tell us that, keep signaling that you recognize Muhammad as the last prophet, this is not, this is more of an excuse for them to show that the civilian government is submitting to them, right? Like it's less about removing the Ahmadis, less about making sure that everybody recognizes that Muhammad is the last prophet. It's more about look at how we get them to bend to our will, right? And to as a demonstration of your influence and your power. And when like Imran Khan says like, oh, I'm gonna do this because I love Muhammad so much, in response to the protests, or when Ahmadis disappear or they get discriminated against, I feel like this is just a signal of power. And then now they're doing that with France as well, right? Like this idea of like, oh, we're anti, get rid of the France ambassador, do this to France, cut ties with France. Is the TLP trying to force the civilian government to do more and more outrageous, unimaginable things that you don't think they would have done so, to market their power? Is that a fair thing to say?
Well, yes, because see, the issue of the prophet's honor, starting with the Danish cartoons in 2005, has become political dynamite. I've never seen anything so powerful in my life. Mm-hmm. Right now, remember the TLP are the guys who branded it, right? They are the Nike or the Apple of love for the prophet. So they are, apologies to Nike and Apple, by the way. Shoot, that would really upset them. So anyway, no, my point is that
they support China's genocide of Uyghur Muslims, so it's fine. It fits their branding, so that's fine.
Yeah, no, but here's the thing, that these guys may be the ones who branded it, but across the board, everyone will bow their knee to the cause of the prophet's honor. It's a very powerful thing. So regardless of the Tehreek-e-Labbaik, all political parties will, between giving lip service and going all the way and to sort of show your loyalty, everyone supports this. So it's not just limited to the TLP. So also you were asking about getting the government to sort of expel the French ambassador. I don't think their interest would be, I don't think that would have to happen for their interest to be served. Just making the demand and shutting the streets down and getting the highest apparatus of the government, higher ministers and all sort of talking to them, gives them that power. It's a bid for power.
Yeah, there's a I think what's, I remember the attack on the bus where the Sri Lankan cricket team came to Pakistan. So this is, you know, this happened many years ago. Is the Sri Lankan cricket team came to Pakistan. The president of the country had vowed that he would protect them personally. He would ensure that they would be safe. And he made this announcement. And, you know, the Pakistani Taliban at the time made it a point to make an attack on that. It was like, okay. And it was a signal, Armin, like you're saying, it is a signal of power that, okay, you've got the civilian government, the president is saying, I'm going to personally protect the team, and look at it. You know, the president's protection, we were able to attack this bus and we were able to do the attack. It's the same thing that they did with the attack on the army compound and then later on the army school. So they were actually waging war against the army. They wanted to show that, okay, not only do we have control, we have power over the civilian government. You know, we can breach their promises of protection. We can breach these army and police compounds, right? The kids where the army sends their the schools where the army sends their kids, we can breach that. So it is a power struggle, and this is how the terrorism works. I mean, people think of terrorism as bombs and bodies and things like that, but
yes,
no,
that's right.
Yeah, it's about the fear. Okay, so when you have a fear that, okay, the people who are supposed to provide us the security, the police compound attacked, the army, their kids killed in school. You have, you know, the present civilian government, well, you know, they can't protect even an international cricket team. Then that terrorizes people.
Yeah, but also I just want to say that I don't think Imran Khan requires the encouragement of the TLP to become a champion for the blasphemy law. I mean, he's positioned himself internationally as a spokesperson for the blasphemy law to the entire Western world. And his sort of his trick to solving it is that I will explain to all the Western nations how this hurts us because Muslims love the Prophet so much. And because I understand the West so well, they will understand and stop doing this. So he's now as a no, it's that's actually what he says, as stupid as it sounds. Now, the thing is, whether he's stupid enough to actually believe that or not, or I don't think anything will come out of that, as we've seen. The point is that he does want to position himself as this international champion for the blasphemy law.
How much of this is because of his... I keep hearing conspiracies about this is his wife influencing him. Is this like people just making up stories, or like I saw like Hayr Sultan was suggesting that this is like Rasputin of like of Pakistan.
You know, he's been pretty consistent. Like, you know, he's like I said, you know, his name was even before this current wife, and he's had three wives. Each one of them has been progressively more and more sort of covered up.
But so what do you think?
From Jemima to the second wife was, you know, perhaps a more or less a gradual slope, but then he plummeted right down to the third one in terms of sort of heading towards
or ascended, depending on who's.
Oh yeah, yeah. Point.
So do you agree that do you think his wife is a major influence in him becoming more Islamist?
Like, no, come on. I mean, that's the whole issue is rife for gossip. I mean, it's something that even, I mean, I don't know whether she is or not, but put it like this: you know, even if she wasn't, it would be the obvious thing to say.
Right.
Yeah, Imran Khan's like a demagogue. Okay, so essentially, he's a populist politician. He's a demagogue. Like every time, you know, Sean, whenever you say that, I don't know what's in his heart. I don't know whether he really believes it. I don't. Whenever you have think about people like that, there are people made comparisons between him and Trump, and although they're not completely accurate, you know, there are some elements there that he is a populist demagogue. He does sort of cater to...
No, I'm only giving him the benefit of the doubt. I'm not claiming to know.
No, I know.
But he does demonstrate expediency. I give you that.
Right. But when he's when we're talking about, you know, whether his wife influences him or not, a lot of that really comes from these people, Armin, that you said had a lot of hope in him. And they thought because, you know, he had all these inspiring speeches. He was in the hospital. He's like, I'm still going to run this election, even though I've been injured. I think he fell off the stage or something. You know, and people just thought that people were moved to tears by him and everything. But it's not anything unexpected. It's just they had this image of him, and it just didn't pan out. It's kind of like when
well, again, that depends on who you are. For his hardcore support base,
right?
He's exactly what they want. I mean, he's got a very strong support base.
Yeah.
Okay, so I wonder where can things go, like how in the short term and in the longer term, where do you see things going? How bad can things get? Like, do we need to be afraid?
Is there going to be an Islamic revolution?
No, well, no, I don't want to ask that. Yeah. I'm just like in the short term and a little bit longer term, where do you see things going?
There's been a gradual decline in this way. Look, Pakistan is a country of contradictions, and Pakistan has an amazing capacity to live with extreme contradictions. So this slide towards this extreme perverted form of Islam, it's almost like a new religion. I just want to say the Ashqi Rasool or the lovers of the Prophet are a strong departure from anything that existed up to 10 years ago. So this brand of Islam is going to grow. And it's over the next, my prediction is that over the next certain amount of time, let's say 10 years, it can only grow because you cannot resist it. You cannot resisting it brings you too much public criticism. No one has the sort of political will or the desire to resist it. So it's almost like virtue signaling that there's a slide down this path. So society is going to become, or let's say social forces are going to become more and more hostage to this way of thinking. But as I said, Pakistan is a land of huge contradictions. So there's always going to be this sort of democratic counterweights and liberal elements in Pakistani society. It's a culture that goes back thousands of years, even despite changes. Not Pakistan, the subcontinental culture.
Okay.
The basic subcontinental culture goes back thousands of years. It's not going to transform in decades. And the other thing is that there won't be a revolution politically. There can't be, because the military is all powerful. The Pakistan military is extremely powerful. It plays these bloody games, but there's no threat to that dynamic. So in a strange way, that sort of guarantees a longevity. But at the same time, it's a curse. It's a curse because it the role of the military in politics and in the economy is very, very destructive.
Yeah.
So no chance of a failed state because of the military.
I don't know. I mean, what is a failed state? I mean, when you don't wake up one day and sort of read in the papers that the state failed this morning. Mm-hmm. A failed state is a gradual malaise, that sort of a hopelessness, a lack of national identity, public conflict.
Failed state in the form like the government just falling apart and just like having to all the institutions and everything, chaos and the natural order of things just falling apart. You know what I mean? Like the rule of law just collapses. Yeah. That form of thing.
But there's the economic element.
Yeah, the economic, like it seemed like, because every time somebody suggests that this might happen in Pakistan, people say the army is way too strong for it to let anything like that happen, right? If that is the case,
militarily. Yeah.
It seems like, as much as we hate the Pakistan's military because of all the terrorist activities they do, should we be rooting for them? Because we don't want we don't want the Islamists to take over a state that has nuclear weapons. Like even as bad as they are, it's in the world's interest for them to succeed. No.
No, because that's an element of Pakistani society. That's an element that actually creates these monsters. It's an element that actually, has created a lot of this. But having said that, and this is also a perverse reality that, you know, in certain parts of the world and in certain states, military governments do happen to be more stable than civilian governments. Saddam's Iraq was much more stable than anything that came after it. Same with Egypt, with Tunisia. Not Tunisia so much, but there is obviously an essential stability that comes with the military, but it's a stability with a curse. It's a stability that is that caters to certain vested interests, as we've seen in Pakistan.
Given what we've seen in the 20th century, it seems like it's a fake kind of stability. It's a stability that is just delays the collapse farther down the road and
or retards progress, right?
Yes. Makes it a bigger collapse, but with a false sense of safety in the meantime. You know what I mean? Like makes the inevitable collapse bigger. Like that's what I think what happens with the military, because it just stifles dissent so much that it gives you an illusion of stability because you don't see dissent because the heavy hand of the military just crushes down. But all that dissent just keeps gathering and gathering and gathering, and eventually the final collapse is going
to be. Well, I think a lot of it is about like there's stability in this progress. So it's sometimes when you have that kind of stability where it's military mediated stability, you know, you'll have a very stable country, but you won't have a lot of innovation, you won't have a lot of progress long term. So, you know, we've seen that
you won't have social progress, right? And for a poor country, mm-hmm. poor countries, especially with the sort of technological breakthroughs happening in the world, poor countries require social progress. Poor, you know, there's a with the rising middle classes in Pakistan with urbanization and access to the rest of the world. The progress is required for society to continue. And in Pakistan, the social development indicators over the decades, now over the long run, over 30 or 40 years, have not improved much. I mean, we have something called millennial development goals about 10 or 15 years ago. Certain standards were set to be attained because that's what running a country eventually is all about. It's not about we are talking about the minutiae, but the story over decades is about social progress. And Pakistan has fallen behind all its neighbors, all the other sort of countries that are part of South Asia. It's below Bangladesh, it's below Nepal, below India in terms of education and other indicators. The malaise in terms of the lack of progress is not a good thing in this day and
age. I wanted to touch on this, you know, this one thing before we go on to patron questions. We have a few minutes left. Yeah, so right now the Biden administration is now disengaging from the region. You know, they're trying to become more and more, you know, let's disengage from the world and go on our own. Meanwhile, you know, you had Imran Khan is getting closer than ever to China. China has always been an ally of Pakistan, mm-hmm. but the influence now, I think, is going to become even more intensified, you know, with a disengaged United States. Recently, in that Axios interview that went viral with Jonathan Swan, where they called him out on his hypocrisy when, and he goes on, talks about Islamophobia, tries to lecture France and all these Western countries, whereas and he completely sidestepped, or well, didn't sidestep, but dismissed the whole question of the Chinese, the Uyghur genocide, which yeah. Jonathan Swan did a great job of interviewing him about.
Pinning him down.
Right. So how do you see this sort of changing the game in the region for Pakistan? With that improved relationship with China, and how does that, will that rope the US back in any way?
Well, I just want to say that this is very destructive in terms of Pakistan's relationship with the US, because every few decades there's a new love affair and then a distancing and a new love affair and a distancing, mm-hmm. Largely driven by American interests. During the 80s, Pakistan was a close ally of the United States in the Clinton years. Then when Clinton came, he arrived. There was a state visit. He came to Pakistan. He addressed the nation from his aircraft, Air Force One, and flew off. He didn't even leave the plane. So what I'm saying is that in the Clinton years, Pakistan was abandoned. Then came 9/11. Suddenly, Pakistan then became a close ally again. And now Biden is distancing. So this is something which is, you know, a very destructive and unhealthy relationship that Pakistan has with the United States, and it's largely driven by U.S. interests. But so of course, I mean there is, you know, as far as China's role is concerned, this is a, you know, internationally, globally, the story of the decade is the rise of Chinese power. If you know, whether you open Fox News or you open The Economist, there's a lot of talk and there's a lot of existential American fear about China. But just on that one note, I just want to say, as far as that interview is concerned with Jonathan Snow, I mean, of course, there's a lot of criticism of Imran Khan, and it is unfortunate that he doesn't see the plight of the Uyghur Muslims. But he's not unique in that. I mean, if you talk to the president of the United States, he's not going to talk about the situation in the occupied territory in Palestine. He's not going to talk about the situation in Kashmir. He's totally blind to that. But he will talk about the Uyghur Muslims because, coincidentally, that is taking place in China, which is an economic rival. So these blind spots are not unique to Imran Khan.
I think it's a little bit more... Like, I mean, I agree with, but it's not to the same extent. Like, for example, at least with the Biden administration, they acknowledge the plight of the Palestinians and they acknowledge that they need to be treated better. Maybe they don't hold Israel maybe accountable to the extent that many people want, but they do talk about the fact that they have, is it, there's, they, you know, they, for example, recently Biden, they wanted to reopen Palestinians embassy in East Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. The United States actually sends aid to the Palestinians and mm-hmm. also to the mm-hmm. Palestinian government. Like, it's not the same level. Like, yes, their language could be a lot better, but I mean, I don't see, like, for example, Pakistan or China to be supporting Uyghurs Muslims to the same level that United States is supporting Palestinians. Like, there are. I don't think it's the same level. Like, yeah, there is blind spot everywhere, but I think, like, that we're talking about a cultural genocide of Uyghur Muslims, and to completely the level of dismissal by Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, it's not, you know, I mean, I criticize the United States for many of their human rights violations all the time, but I think on this, I think Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and China are at a whole other level.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree with you in terms of levels, and it's debatable sort of like in the Palestinian context. Sort of, there may be some support to the Palestinian cause, but it's the support is where there are two, let's say, sides in some kind of conflict. The support is very, very lopsided towards one part of it. But there's obviously different standards with which you uphold, with which you view a superpower, which sees itself as the sort of defender of human rights. It's called for itself to be seen with different standards. Pakistan doesn't play that role, but that's all sort of that's the minutiae. It doesn't take away the fact that, yes, I mean, it's an embarrassing thing to
it
say.
Does,
Uyghur
it does
Muslims, Uyghur Muslims.
It does see itself as a defender of Muslims and Islam internationally.
Rhetorically.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's rhetoric.
Yeah. Okay, Ali, we do need to highlight the.
Yeah, let's do the patent questions.
There we go.
Yeah, there's so much. I could talk about here, but anyway, we'll just do this in the interest of time. Susanna saying, when Haris Sultan covers a recent TLP mass mobilization, he intimates that there is a possibility of an Islamic revolution a la Iran 79. Oh, so this is something that I was joking about earlier, but is it? Do you see that kind of thing happening potentially? Well, I mean, Armin also, you know, you were also talking about the Shah and how he
let the Islamists go out.
Yeah, I think this is before I asked that. So I didn't, I think we addressed that one. I think she asked this before I brought it up. But interesting that Susanna's mind went there. Here's another Susanna question.
Okay, so Susanna, second round. Can Sean expand on the Diobandi versus Bareilvi contention that he mentioned in the pre-show? That's correct. Yeah, we were talking about that, and we didn't get around to it in this spot in this when we were live.
That's a huge sort of topic by itself. Basically, 75% of Sunni Pakistan is Bareilvi, 25% is Deobandi. Deobandi ideology is more aligned to Saudi Salafism. So when the Afghan Jihad came, it was the Deobandis which were the more logical recruiting ground. So a lot of money was poured into Deobandi Islam. Deobandi is similar to Saudi sort of Islam.
Wahhabism, yeah, kind of.
Salafism, Wahhabism, it's similar. And it's doctrinal. See, Bareilvi Islam is sort of more in the shrines. It's less doctrinal. It's more like of the earth, right? So basically what happened in the 80s is that the Deobandis were heavily funded. Bareilvi shrines and mosques were converted into Deobandi mosques because they were on the gravy train of the Afghan Jihad. And disproportionately to its numbers, Deobandi Islam was very powerful in Pakistan. But then sort of with the coming of the blasphemy issue about 10 years ago, I think Bareilvism had a bit of a sort of suffered a religious Stockholm syndrome. You know, why are we sort of left out of the party? And the blasphemy issue was the lightning rod that galvanized the Bareilvi cause. And that is probably why they hold on to this cause so dearly, because it is their ticket to power and their ticket to relevance.
Amazing. Yeah. Okay.
Bulbul is saying, how will the expulsion of the French ambassador affect Pakistan's international relations and economy? And everybody's after the French now, right? Like the US.
Yeah, but, I mean, he's not going to be expelled. Yeah. But if, I think she means, right? If he gets
I think it would be a disaster internationally. It would make Pakistan a pariah nation. If you don't have a French embassy in your country, in this day and age, you're a pariah nation. I mean, how can you not have it would be a joke. It would be a national embarrassment.
Unless
regardless,
it's about
I don't think Pakistan will ever do that.
Yeah. It
the military, they can't do it.
It can't, because there's billions of dollars of trade, and it wouldn't just be France that you have to deal with. It's the entire European Union that you have to deal with.
No, and then you're creating a cascade of them daring other countries to also then create a cartoon, and you know then people do this, they pick up the dare, and you know there'll be another cartoon, and you know, of course Denmark has had a cartoon, and then you know it'll who all are you going to expel, and for what? What are the goods at the end of this road? Sort of, you know, more
the financial cost. It would be so much that it's very unexpected. That is it possible that the TLP knows that it's impossible for them to do this, and they just want to pressure them to give them something else instead because they will fail at giving them this request?
Yeah, like I said, the demand is more powerful than its fulfillment.
Right,
right.
The fact that they hold the country hostage is what gives them their power. So regardless of whether it's, you know, fulfilled or not.
Like they killed four police officers, and they've had hundreds of their prisoners released, and now they've been unbanned. I mean, this is a huge negotiating tool.
I mean, it's kind of genius. Ask for something impossible and then get them to say like, we can't do this. And then get what you wanted get what you actually wanted to begin with, you know, and this is like powerful negotiating tactics.
Yeah, it's
right?
The same. Yeah, it's a flexing of muscle over the institutions of the country that they want to show the power.
Well, you just have to look at the negotiation terms between the TLP and the government of Pakistan whenever these inverted commas negotiations take place. The contention of the TLP is do this for us, fulfill our demands, and we'll stop burning the country down. And the government is saying, please stop burning the country down. What is the minimum we can do to satisfy you now? And somewhere they sort of agree. And government negotiators and TTP negotiators sort of come out with press conferences congratulating each other over successful negotiations after prisoners have been released, police officers have been killed. Sort of they sort of, you know, it's like some great summit has just taken place. So just the negotiation terms shows you how lopsided the power equation is in this perverted relationship.
The Pakistani government is a victim of terrorism. That's basically what it is. I mean, they are victims of terrorism. They're being terrorized.
Well, I mean, they spread terrorism outside of Pakistan. Actually, I shouldn't say that. but I was going to say, so basically the TLP knows that they could get their prisoners freed like this every time. The top prisoners free every time they want. And also by every time they burn the country down, when they come and negotiate with them and give them something they want, isn't that like encouraging them? Like, isn't that a signal that like they want them to stop burning the country down, but this doesn't this to encourage them to do it again?
It's incentivizing them because there's no cost. There's no penalty on the TLP for these demonstrations and these demands. And the government has created that mechanism. I don't know whether out of weakness, but it's created that relationship where the TLP benefits every time it does this.
And this is why you don't negotiate with terrorists, because now they know that this works. Last Patreon question.
Yeah, this is Dee Boudreau. This is a good question. I think this is something that I've always wondered too. It seems that the cop killers keep getting pardoned. What does this mean to the institution of the police force? And why wouldn't they want to switch sides? So, you know, the cop killers getting pardoned, that's an interesting thing. But I think the second part of it is even more interesting, that the institution of the police force, and we saw this again, we talked earlier about how the Taliban also attacked police compounds to show that flex of power that, you know, we have control over this. Right now, the same kind of thing happened here with the killing of the four police officers. How's the police different from the army? Why is the police...
It's because the police is the civilian government and not the army. They wouldn't be this free in going after these people if they were the army, would they?
No, but that's, I mean, Dee has sort of put her finger sort of on the pulse. That's the issue. There is a fear in the police and the army, and that's one reason why you can't crack down on the TLP. Because there's, like I said, they may not have a lot of votes, but large, perhaps most of the country is sympathetic. It's very alluring, the honor of the prophet, and it's distilled in very simple terms. We are protecting the honor of the prophet, and the average, I suspect, policeman is not very analytical, and is, you know, not policeman, but across the board, it's very easy to fall into this trap that these people are protecting the honor of the prophet. So it's a danger for the police force. It's also a danger for the army. Whenever there was and there have been fatwas against the chief of army staff, the chief of army staff has genuine reason to fear, if there's a fatwa against him, that someone will take their life. See, it's a smart bomb. It's the world's most powerful smart bomb to put a fatwa out against someone and ask any believer to murder him. The reason it's a smart bomb is that you never know who will kill you then. So it's a very powerful and, dare I say, insidious tool.
It could be your own bodyguard, as we've seen. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
it's really hard to fall asleep at night with that kind of, with a fatwa in your head.
Oh yeah, so that is also it's a mixture of how alluring it is and how difficult it is to oppose it, which is why we see a sort of a slide towards Ashq-e Rasool, the love of the Prophet.
Yeah.
Well, so today we learned that when your country is entirely based on Islam and nothing but Islam, everything turns into a nightmare. Who would have expected that? Amazing.
I think the most telling thing is the two Nobel laureates that we have in Pakistan. Abdus Salam, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics. He was Ahmadi, so he's pretty much had to exile himself from the country so he could live and work freely. And the other is Malala Yousafzai, who recently got married. Congratulations, Malala.
Congratulations, Malala, yes.
And, you know, and she is also probably cannot return to Pakistan safely at this point. So there's a... I think that unfortunately tells a lot. I hope things change. Are you optimistic, pessimistic? Do you still have hope?
Is there any hope? Give us some hope, please.
I know your father did.
Of course there is. I mean, there's a growing middle class in Pakistan. There's very strong democratic institutions in the country. There's a very strong rule of law in Pakistan, and these are traditions that have held for the last 70 years. They've seen through martial laws. Remember, Pakistan, the people of Pakistan, democratic movements in Pakistan got rid of General Zia, fought martial law for 11 years. Well, no, eventually it was a bomb that got rid of him, but resisted martial law for 11 years. After 11 years of martial law, by popular political power, a political government came into place. The other thing I just want you guys to remember, just going back in history, sort of pre-partition India, that includes Pakistan, is the home of the largest non-violent independence struggle in history.
Right.
We don't need lessons in these things. There are very strong democratic traditions in Pakistan. Yes, there are dangers ahead of us, but I don't think the slide is inevitable, and I don't think the slide is in one direction. But that doesn't discount that there are dangers ahead of us.
Right.
Perfect.
Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, so thank you, Sean, again, for coming here.
Always a pleasure, guys. This is my fifth time, or?
Fourth time.
We will have you on many more times. It's always amazing. We always learn so much from you. It's always so much fun. Even though the topic is depressing, you somehow make it more tolerable to listen to because of the charm effect.
Sean, like whenever we talk, this Pakistan thing is one reason that we call him on. But I think you have a lot of really interesting and opinions that we definitely have conversations about all kinds of things, so I think it'd be kind of fun to have some of those publicly as well.
Are you sure we don't have to censor them?
Let's see what we
edit, so the live chat is saying great show. Music guy is saying amazing guest. Susanna is saying I learned a lot. D is saying thank you, good info. And guys, by the way, if you are listening to the audio version of this, the people who are watching this live with us, they're the patrons. If you guys want to participate in this conversation and ask your questions live or ahead of time, link in the description, become a patron. If you're listening to the audio version of this, that means you're listening to this later. So consider becoming patrons so you could join us live with the rest of us here when we have these shows. Ali?
If you're watching us or listening to us on YouTube, please hit the like button and hit the subscribe button and hit the bell notification so you can actually be notified every time we have more videos like this. If you are listening to us on your podcast app, please go and give us a rating because it helps us feature higher so that more people can hear these things. And as Armin said, if you want to participate and send your questions, if you become a patron, you can send your questions earlier and we'll prioritize those questions and read them out and answer them first. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/sjme for as little as a dollar a month, and you'll get access to 5 or 6 live streams a month, and you'll be able to participate in these conversations and actually engage with our guests and us.
And we almost forgot. Where, Sean, can we people find you and follow you? And
they can find me on Twitter. That's my name, by my name, which you see on the screen here. And you can find me on Facebook as well.
Well, actually, Ali, can you? It's S because
of Shaan Taseer at Shaan Taseer. That's where Shaan is. On,
yeah, so for
and definitely follow his work. I mean, he's yes, he's always got a very, very interesting feed on all of his social media.
Hope to hear from your guests.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so
right, Shaan, man, thank you very much.
Bye. Thanks, guys. See you all soon.
Yeah, yeah. See you
soon. The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends, write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions, or head over to secularjihadists.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.